So I'm speaking with Wayne McIntosh, who is working for the Commonwealth of Learning and best known for his association with WikiEducator, which he started. And he offered to do a case study about one of his projects that are part of the WikiEducator community called Learning for Content. And I'll just hand over to Wayne. And Wayne, tell us what the project is about.
Thanks, Philip, and thanks for the opportunity for inviting us to join your course. I think it's a great project and really looking forward to participating and interacting with colleagues around the world. The Learning for Content initiative is really our main capacity building initiative for the WikiEducator project. And before I talk about Learning for Content, let me just place this in the wider context of the WikiEducator initiative. WikiEducator was started in May 2006, largely as an initiative focusing on turning the digital divide into digital dividends, using open networks and OERs, free content development. It is a community of educators. At the moment, we are have over 8,500 educators from around the world that are collaborating on developing free content. The community, the profile of the community is quite interesting. 72% of our users are educators, either teachers, lecturers, or trainers in the formal education sector. So it is a very strong educational community. Our gender distribution is roughly 50-50, which we are pretty happy about. The distribution between education sectors, roughly about 25% from the school sector and 50% from the tertiary education sector. So we're looking at how we can expand work in the school sector. The most interesting statistic that we have of our new users is our age profile, with more than half of our users being over 45 years of age.
Wow.
Which for us was quite surprising.
Yes.
Because we were kind of expecting, sort of the 22-year-old web geeks joining the project. So this is a very good sign of educators wanting to get involved with the use of these collaborative authoring technologies in an open environment. So that's a little bit of our profile.
Mm-hmm.
The strategy is a simple strategy. We're aiming in collaboration with the free knowledge movement to develop educational resources in support of all national curricula under free content licenses by 2015. And I guess you're going to say to me, Wayne, that's a bit of a crazy ambition. You're not going to get that right by 2015. My view on this is quite simple. If we don't get it right by 2015, 2017 will be just fine. So it's going to happen. It's inevitable. I don't think it's any more a question of, is this going to happen? I think it's now a question of when. We've got to get a lot smarter on our planet in with regards to educational provision. We've got huge challenges. I mean, take sub-Saharan Africa, for example. If we look at the enrollment or the gross enrollment ratios for the last 3 years of the school system, we see that 76% of the children of the school-going age for those last 3 years are not going to have the opportunity of, ever being in the classroom or have the privilege of, interacting with the teacher. It's just not going to happen. I mean, if we look at North America, over the last two decades, the increase in tuition fees has been in excess of the inflation index. And, I mean, mm-hmm. that's a system which is just fundamentally, unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, at an international level, we've got to get a lot smarter at what we're doing. And, I mean, fortunately, open education resources are both a renewable and a sustainable resource. So, hence, I just think it's inevitable that, this is the way that we're going to go. And it makes just so much more sense for us to be collaborating on content in ways that make it easier for us to share reuse, repurpose, and you know, and remix that content for a, you know, a variety of educational contexts.
Wait. Let me ask you a question. Is your experience here that on one hand the open content or free content movement can drive down costs of these resources? So that's one part. But also, I'm interested in, since you're so strong in the formal education sector, do you see the free education or open education movement changing the formal education sector, or also creating alternatives to what we have previously considered the formal education sector? And will that be a way to address some of those challenges?
Oh, inevitably, I mean, pushing the envelope a little and thinking a little outside the box. I often say that there was life before school. And what I mean by that is, if we look at the formal school system as we know it, it is essentially a consequence of the industrialization of society. That the way in which we've organized education has grown in parallel with the, you know, industrialization of society. So similarly, you know, if there was life before school, in the traditional sense as we know it, I suppose we could plausibly speculate that there will be life after school.
Hmm.
So, you know, it is certainly conceivable that we will see alternate education delivery systems emerging. And, you know, I suspect that this, you know, that this is going to happen. The context is such that in order to, you know, for us to even remotely address the global demand for education, we are going to have to find alternate systems in parallel with the formal sector. And, you know, a way this might work is if, you know, if we have a free curriculum, you know, that is available, or resources to support, you know, curricula around the planet, it makes it a lot easier for informal learning scenarios for folk to self-organize themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect what we will see happening, and I certainly hope that we will see this happening within the developing world, is that we see national governments working towards supporting the disaggregation of the total package of educational services. We typically associate with a formal education institution, so that we could, for example, have, you know, informal learning through the use of open education resources, community self-organizing, but around the credentialization, that people would have the opportunity of, you know, sitting a national credential or whatever, in parallel with, you know, sort of the community-driven credentialization that we have grown very familiar with in the open source movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's certainly possible.
Interesting, yeah.
And what I particularly like about the open education content movement is it doesn't discriminate between the formal or informal sectors. I mean, the very fact that you can share, reuse, and remix educational materials means that it can be used in any, you know, educational context. So, OER that's developed for the formal sector can migrate quite easily into the informal sector, mm-hmm. and vice versa as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You speak quite a lot about developing countries, and one of the responses that I often get when I speak about OER in developing countries, people say, yeah, but there's a lack of capacity. And so I'm wondering, is learning for content also a way to build capacity across the globe for people to produce and share and remix free OERs, open educational resources?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Learning for Content project is, in fact, the world's largest attempt to build wiki skills for educators, you know, in the history of the planet. But then again, that said, it doesn't take much to achieve that accolade. yes, I mean, it's really about building capacity for educators to actually engage in using these technologies. And it's an interesting model because it's an immersion apprenticeship model. Educators acquire their skills within the live wiki environment, so it's not a simulated education. All the learners create the user pages in, you know, the wiki educator environment within the community. The content that they develop is within the community, And from that perspective, it's a very powerful project because it mimics the the apprenticeship model. Our motto within WikiEducate is just just try it. Our community will support you, mm-hmm. and we don't mind whatever levels and whatever skill level educators come into learning for content. We're there to support them, and I've had the privilege of presenting face-to-face learning for content workshops because we have two formats, both the online format, which there's at least one online workshop every month, as well as face-to-face workshops in different parts of the world. And having had the privilege of presenting these face-to-face workshops in developing countries in the four region of the four regions in which we work, the Caribbean, Africa, the Pacific region, and Asia, of course. I typically would ask the participants how many of you have ever published the World Wide Web, and inevitably nobody puts up their hand. And then I make a commitment to the group saying, well, by tea time this morning, each and every one of you would have published to the World Wide Web. And, being a wiki, it's not that, not that hard to get right. Hmm. But it's incredibly empowering to know that within the span of, an hour or two, individuals who have never published to the web from parts of the world that typically have just been consumers of content from other parts of the world are now empowered to, develop content themselves. And, it's just amazing. So, The other neat thing about this project is, it's very much a low-cost model. We provide free training either in face-to-face formats or online format. And the deal is that participants will pay for, in inverted commas, for their training by donating a little of their knowledge back to the community. So the thinking here is they must either, develop a lesson plan or some content resource, which is going to help them in their work. But at the same time, donating back to the community.
Yeah, that's a great model. And do you have people who come through the course then start teaching the course as well? I mean, are graduates starting to teach new groups?
Yeah, I mean, that's been pretty amazing. The targets for our project were when we set up the initiative, because Learning for Content has been funded, by the Commonwealth of Learning, and we've also have received a grant from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for supporting the training around the world, which has been a great help. But when we started the project, we had a total of three folk who were in a position to be able to facilitate these workshops, and our targets were to train under the first series of the Learning for Content project 2,500 educators. So it was a pretty ambitious target, but the model is scalable in two ways. One, through participating in these Learning for Content workshops, a number of educators self-identify as prospective trainers, and with the result we now have about 30 facilitators across the globe, in all regions of the globe, who have facilitated are in a position to help facilitate these face-to-face workshops, and that has been and these are graduates of the Learning for Content program.
Wow.
It's just amazing. So in the span of little over a year, we've increased our number of facilitators tenfold. But what is also, sort of a very interesting facet of the scalability of this project is the ability to actually identify participants, that enroll in the course. And, if you're wanting to find 2,500 educators, it's a big task, to find, participants. And this is helped by the fact that we are part of this, this large global education community, which actually feeds enrollments in the program. So, we started Learning for Content in the beginning of last year, Mm-hmm. And as of the 30th of March, we have had 2,326 educators enrolled for the program.
Wow.
Having presented to date 73 workshops. Now, if you're going to do the math around that, you know, the 52 weeks in the year, so add on 3 months, you know, add on, you know, 12. Our average is more than one workshop a week.
Wow, that's incredible.
But I mean, yeah, and this is possible because of, you know, the open model. People, you know, they can self-organize, you know, through open content licensing. The you know, the project is infinitely scalable, and we've got had examples from around the world where folk have, you know, presented these workshops of, you know, of their own accord. I mean, because what we do, being a low-cost initiative, we just have a simple, you know, small honorarium of $1,000 Canadian per workshop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is used in a variety of ways. It's, you know, it's either used to defray local catering costs for face-to-face workshops or to support a, you know, a facilitator's honorarium fee. I mean, candidly, we don't have an issue of how that bounty is actually utilized. So, you know, the host institutions that are running these workshops, you know, have freedom in terms of how they want to apply that bounty. And, you know, and there's a bit of self-selection that goes on through the institutions, because one of the requirements we have in terms of, you know, host institution facilitating one of these workshops is that they have to donate the, you know, the computer lab, for example. Mm-hmm. So at least there's, you know, a high level of institutional buy-in in, you know, in running these workshops. Yeah.
Let me ask a question about that, because in this Mozilla course, we're really looking at three areas. One is open content licensing, one is open technology, yep. and one is open pedagogy. And so I'm wondering about the open licensing in this. When you get institutions involved and people from all over the world, what's been their response to the? I mean, are there licensing guidelines? Do people have to license under a particular license, or is there some flexibility, and how have people responded to that?
It's a very good question, and also not a trivial question. I mean, a copyright is a minefield of its own, and, you know, why we create these problems for ourselves is beyond me, but that's another issue. The Wiki Educator project, like the Wikimedia Foundation projects, we subscribed to the free cultural works definition, and our interpretation of what free content is guided by the essential freedoms that were laid down by the Free Software Foundation. Mm-hmm. And in short, what that basically means is, under the Creative Commons suite of licenses, we only support two of the alternatives, namely the Creative Commons Attribution License, mm-hmm. and the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike License, because those are the two which meet the requirements of the Free Cultural Works definition. Mm-hmm. And you will see, in fact, that if you go and visit, you know, Creative Commons, and, you know, you'll select your licenses, and if you select either the CC BY or the CC BY SA license, that you will see there's a Free Cultural Works logo approved identifier on those two license choices. So, I mean, the deal is with projects like Wiki Educator, we are an open content, free content initiative, and we are driven by, you know, a core set of values, and one of those values are the values around what around free content and the meaning that we apply to what we mean by free content. And I mean, for example, I mean, we do not support the non-commercial restriction at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
We feel that it is, in fact, it's going to, it's the non-commercial restriction, in our view, is not going to be sustainable over the long term. It's a restriction which just doesn't make sense at all. But I mean, the issue is, in many education institutions, it kind of feels good, mm-hmm. to add a non-commercial restriction, you know, onto content. You know, after all, you know, we publicly funded institutions, and, mm-hmm. you know, we're doing this for the, you know, the betterment and improvement of education for all. Therefore, it makes sense that we shouldn't add a non-commercial restriction.
It feels right to say non-commercial.
It feels, yeah, absolutely, it feels right. But when you start, you know, you start going into it and you start analyzing, well, okay, if we believe in the values of the freedoms, the essential freedoms, then you know we should apply these values universally. I mean, you can't kind of say, well, you know, I believe in free education, you know, but if you're going to charge for it, I actually don't believe in freedom anymore.
Yeah.
So you know, it's an interesting challenge. But by the same token, I do understand why education institutions want to protect themselves against commercial exploitation. Mm-hmm. The way to do that more effectively is through the share-alike provision, you know, the copyleft component of a license. Mm-hmm. Because then, if any content, you know, any content that is released under a free content license, and any derivative works or value additions to that content, then need to be released legally, need to be released back to the community under the same license. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, there are different perspectives around this. There's a strong school of thought which says, you know, the share-alike provision is an additional restriction, which is a limitation of freedom. And therefore, it's better to use a more open license, a more pervasive license, like the, just, you know, the attribution license. But you know, we support both views on this perspective, and the philosophical difference is really about, well, what freedoms are you trying to protect?
Yeah.
The freedoms of the actual content, or the freedoms of future users of that content?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's a decision which educators, you know, need to think about, and institutions, of course, need to think about very carefully.
Yeah, it's a really it's a really interesting question, and also interesting for me, because I've now done four of these interviews, and there are different opinions on these issues. And I think everyone kind of shares, I'd say, 90% of the values of this movement, but then it gets so complicated once you start looking at these details, and people, you know, start looking at the different options. And and we actually, that's one of the reasons why we have a seminar in week four, where Lila Bailey, who's the counsel from CC Learn, is going to come and look at, well, give us a little introduction, but then also look at how the case studies have used licensing and some of the reasons behind those, some of the motivations. So it's great that you're actually providing that information already. I'm going to point people back to your statements here during week four, I think.
Yeah, I mean, with pleasure. I mean, you know, licensing is a challenging area. But, you know, at the end of the day, as an educator myself, I think sometimes we get a little, you know, too concerned with the licensing issues, because very often you find a situation where licenses are used as a mechanism to try and regulate intent.
Yeah.
Where I don't think that this is what this is about. The open education resource movement, from my perspective, in many ways, is a return to the traditions of the academy, or the return to the traditions of education, and simply this. I mean, that the prime purpose of education is to share knowledge. This is what we do. So. I mean, the next logical step is, you know, open education content, and sharing knowledge freely. There is this strange or misconception, in fact, I think, among many universities around the world, that if we open up our content, we're going to lose competitive advantage.
Hmm.
So that, you know, there are institutions that think that their course content is, you know, what brings them in or what helps sustain themselves. But the reality is, I mean, I just think back to my own, studying career. I've never selected an institution or university where to study based on the prescribed text that, you know, the courses are prescribing. It's just not the way we think.
Absolutely not.
So, I mean, increasingly, we're seeing with, you know, the Cape Town Open Declaration, a growing number of institutions around the world that are committing to these values. And the institution which I will be joining now, Otago Polytechnic, with the establishment of the Open Education Resource Foundation, is in fact a wonderful example. To the best of my knowledge, they are the first tertiary education institution in the world who have adopted a blanket intellectual property policy which defaults to a Creative Commons attribution license, which basically means all content that is generated through the, through the institution and its staff will default to a Creative Commons attribution license. And I mean, and the neat thing about the Creative Commons licensing is that the individual authors, individual academics are not sacrificing their copyright.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are still the legal copyright holders. They are not giving up their moral rights on these materials. And more importantly, they still retain the right, assuming they haven't, they're not using the non-commercial restriction. People still retain their right to earn a living from free content. And what is better than that? I mean, who are we as, educators to refuse the right of an entrepreneur, let's say in rural Uganda, who is repackaging content in ways and distributing them in ways that widen access to, high quality learning opportunities, and at the same time, retains the right to earn a living. I mean, and it's a healthy model because income generation stays within the country, and it's the way we need to go. And yeah. I firmly believe that sustainability of the open education resource movement will come through these creative partnerships. And I mean, we must remember there will always be a no-cost digital version of the content always available.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting what you're saying here. Sometimes reminds me of this... it's almost like people are, it's not about the economic loss to themselves, but it's if someone else makes money, somehow that reduces the value that I have. And that's a strange notion, which I think is not a very old notion. I think that has come over the last, with industrialization and with the movement to protect, in inverted commas, more of our intellectual works. I think there's this feeling now that it's unfair if someone else does something with it. And for me, that's a very strange notion in the context of the academy. But yeah. Wayne, unfortunately, we have to come to an end. Hopefully you're going to be in the second week seminar where we have all the case studies. And hopefully you'll be able to participate on the mailing list a little bit. It's a little more difficult with you because of the time zone that you are in. But I really appreciate the time you've taken here and shared all these all your thoughts on a whole range of issues, which are fit in perfectly with the three themes of this course. So thank you very much.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Philip, and I'll certainly be joining the email lists, and I look forward to sharing ideas and thoughts with the participants in this group. And yeah, it's a great project, and I hope to see it grow. You can adopt the learning for content delivery model and scale this up across the planet.
Yeah. Yes. I think the goal should be a course a week. I think that's what you were doing now.
Yeah. And it's doable. We've shown that you can do it.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
All right, Philip. Thanks.
You.